Right. So, anyway, the end of all that was, so at the age of nine, I think it was nine, was it eight or nine, I started piano lessons and started playing sousaphone in the school band, which I hated. Being a fat kid, being forced to play the sousaphone, I utterly hated it from day one. I always felt like it had been foisted upon me, and it was a miserable experience. But I continued it to the end of high school because it allowed me, because there were other things. And anyway, the gist of that was because I could read bass clef and play guitar, the junior high school stage band director decided that I needed to play bass guitar. And hence, that's how I got involved with the bass.
Do you think there's some kind of thing going people's that musical understanding that we were talking about earlier, why they make fat kids play low instruments?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and then no one realizes that they're doing it when they're doing that shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, absolutely.
This is definitely something wired in the brain.
And girls play flute.
Yeah, make a low sound is a big fat round note.
Girls don't play drums. And if they play guitar, they're supposed to play like hippie acoustic guitar. You know, we have all these kind of things. Fat kids play the low brass.
Yeah.
And
What do you think it's all about?
Because
we go about Ramachandran, and I think it's actually related to Boo Boo Kiki type shit.
But yeah, I would think that's probably true. Yeah, absolutely. You're bigger, the instruments are bigger. So there's also the thing of like, well, he could carry it.
Yeah.
Right? Which is assuming that you're somehow physically stronger because you're...
Yeah, which is
kind of funny because in our society we have this idea that fat people are out of shape, but then we can make them play the low brass instruments because they're stronger and they can carry them around.
Right.
Right? So, whatever.
Yeah, it's pretty strange, right? In reverse. So, at what point did you start playing out? Start playing with people, I guess, is really the question.
Okay, the different things. When I started playing the sousaphone, of course, I was playing in school bands.
Right.
When I was playing the piano, my first set of piano lessons was with a woman named Diana Arlick, who was a great piano educator, who had been to Juilliard, and she had us memorize pieces and play at recital, which terrified me. Totally terrified me. This idea of playing the piece and having people pay attention, you know, suddenly become silent. Anyway, so that completely terrified me. So those were my first performing experiences. And I sang in school plays or something. But then when I was very young, I sort of played with some other guys, like just... I had a cheesy little organ that had like push buttons for chords.
Oh, yeah.
And there was another kid who played guitar, and we'd worked out how to play incense and peppermints. this is like at the age of 11 or something. Yeah. And then around then the elementary school band director, when I think I was in junior high school, started his own big band in his basement with a bunch of the more talented kids and his own kids called the Funky Turtles. And we played some Count Basie arrangements and stuff. I mean, I remember we played Lil Darlin and stuff, which was actually pretty good stuff. We played a lot of cheesy stuff too, like the Herb Alpert things. But so I was doing that, and of course playing the school stuff. And then when I was a freshman in high school, this kind of crazy kid who sat in front of me turned around and asked me if I wanted to be in his rock band, and I was like, oh, yes. And that was this guy, John Van Wee, who I then formed a lifelong relationship with. He had a band, and he was playing... he had a three-piece band that was doing... Jimi Hendrix and Creedence Clearwater Revival and Rolling Stones and Steppenwolf and whatever and that was right at the time that, so, you know, it's like they were playing like Jimmy and Cream, and the live records were coming out, you know, and Johnny Winter, and on the live records we heard these guys, they were improvising like crazy, mm-hmm. you know, so we assumed that's what you're supposed to do. So we would play versions of Born to Be Wild that were like 15 minutes long, mm-hmm. and just like take the whole middle section and turn it into an orgiastic, ecstatic improvisation. And so that's what I thought you were just, that's what we thought you were supposed to do as musicians. Yeah. And then when we got exposed to people who actually like learned the songs the way they were on the records and played them, we were kind of shocked and taken aback by that whole idea and didn't really think it was very kosher, you know, because it didn't involve the act of creation, which we thought was the whole thing.
Where do you think that idea came from?
I don't know.
Yeah, it just came up.
I guess I think, you know, there were bands that did that before and bands who did that after
and during,
you know, there was yeah and during
those bands, some of those bands you're thinking of there mentioning,
yeah, and so any case we didn't know, so I mean, I can remember, I saw somebody just the other day, I remember the first song that we actually like sat down all together and like learned the arrangement the way that it was on the record, and that was Smoke on the Water by Deep Purple.
Wow.
And we had the lock on the local junior high school dances where we were making, and we got paid $40 a man. Which I will still go out and play a gig for $40.
Probably, I'm expecting that. I would say in the medium, it's $5 more than some gigs that I pay.
Yes, yes, to this day. And that was back in the year, you know, early 70s. So,
yeah, yeah,
you know, it was like, I was really hot shit. what was I going to say? Oh, and the other thing that happened around that time is my next door neighbors had this big house. And this was, you know, the early 70s, and there's a lot of kind of crazy stuff going on. And the woman was looking to rent out a room, and this guy, Jack Lovinger, pulled up, and he was like a hippie driving around the country with his girlfriend Karen in, and they were living in a converted milk truck. And they pulled up, and she didn't actually have a room available for them, so they were actually lived in the milk truck on this kind of commune that I grew up on. And Jack was a jazz drummer. And there was a barn. And so he set up his drums in the barn and called up his friends to come over and jam every weekend. And he called me up, and he knew a couple guitar players, and he called me up to come and play bass. Mm-hmm. And they played free. And so this was my other experience, was like going and playing with these guys in a, you know, getting incredibly stoned, and I was like 14, and these guys were in their later, you know, in their 30s, 20s, whatever, and they were actually accomplished musicians, and then we would play free improvisation.
Mm-hmm.
So once again, I was apparently getting the wrong information.
About what?
That is to say, the wrong information for going to jazz school, learning to, you know, do it all properly.
As right.
I was sort of given the idea that, you know, you used your ear and your spirit and reacted to what was going on around you, and that's what, you know, playing that stuff was like.
But did you have any, now you keep saying that, again, you got the wrong idea. Were you already conscious of the fact there were people that had another idea?
No, at that time I wasn't really. I don't think I was really that there was.
Okay, so this is it. This
but,
is that,
you know, and at the same time, so then I'd also, when I was 14, I switched to studying composition and piano with Arthur Cunningham, who was one of America's great black American, one of the great African American composers.
How did you come across this fellow?
He lived in Nyack, uh-huh. And I got fed up of the classical piano lessons, and I couldn't take the recitals, and I didn't like the culture of it, really. You know, the whole idea of being neat and clean and well-groomed and polite just really just always sickened me to death. You know, I was an urchin. essentially.
And this is, we're talking still about, we're pre-Columbia here.
Yeah, this is, so now we're talking, like, I stopped studying with Diana Arlick after like 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. And I took a year off or so. And when I left her, I said I want to study jazz piano, and she gave me the names of two guys. One was this guy Vincent Hill, and the other was this guy Arthur Cunningham. Now, I had an older friend, Frank Cohen, who is out in California these days, and he was studying with Arthur, and so I went to study with Arthur, and then he turned out to be this guy.
And what was Arthur, where was Arthur Cunningham come from? What was he playing? What did he play? What did he talk about?
Arthur had studied stride and classical piano from a very early age.
When you say studied, he studied, who did he study with somebody, or did he just study?
No, I believe he had lessons on stride, and I think he had like lessons that were like he would go and study with whoever it was who taught him stride.
Sorry, that's just my cell phone.
Whoever it was who studied, and then he also went and studied classical piano. I imagine there'll be a biography one of these days, so I don't want to get wrong information.
I'm interested because what's interesting me here is what was interesting about him to you.
Oh, well, first of all, I wanted to study jazz. He was very, very dynamic and amazing guy,
uh-huh.
Right? And he was terrific with kids, and I went to study with him. And first he said, like, well, bring in whatever, you know, music you're interested in. And I didn't know. So I had, like, a songbook for Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young,
mm-hmm.
or something, you know, because I was playing the guitar, mm-hmm. playing the stuff. And so I brought that in, and he looked that stuff over, and he was kind of like, okay. and of course you could tell that I was playing it all wrong, because that's another thing that I'd done from very early ages. I would recompose the pieces.
Mm-hmm. How did you say you're recompose? Let's go with the idea of recomposing. What do people usually mean? Then let's go to what you thought you were doing.
Well, when I was a kid, I think I was playing them wrong,
uh-huh.
which is I was adjusting them to my coherence creating scenario or whatever. But I would show up at the lesson and I'd be playing the piece and it would be different than what was on the paper,
mm-hmm.
because I had decided it sounded better if you did this.
How far distant were we talking about?
Don't remember.
Are we talking about like it was clearly just mistakes, or you had completely restructured the whole thing? And
no. It was more like occasional deciding to use different chromatic stuff, or it was like changing the notes, maybe just changing the shape of the melody or the rhythm a little bit, you know,
in a way that would give you the idea of even if you look back later as just drawing a variation, or like just you were just like this will do, or this will work, or this keeps me in the fantasy of playing the song, or
none of those.
Good.
No,
okay.
I was fixing them.
You're fixing them. Okay, so they actually sounded like there was things that were incorrect.
I thought that they sounded better.
That's great.
You know, it's like I like it this way. I don't put this extra note in here, and mm-hmm. that F sharp, that sounds better if it's F natural. And I decided to play this chord twice. You know, I was just, I don't know. I just
and did you get that?
It happened naturally. It wasn't something I really thought about.
Okay, but the reason I'm asking
might be,
at this
crazy.
Point is because you'd already. Yes, but the thing is, you already had music knowledge from playing the piano. You knew what the notes were, the names of the notes.
Oh, and the one thing that I had really freakish talent for was music theory.
And when you say you had freakish talent, tell me how. Was she explaining music theory to you?
We had music theory lessons once a month,
mm-hmm.
as a part of our recital situation. Mm-hmm. We would go, and she called it group,
mm-hmm.
and we would sit at different tables and work through these little music theory books,
mm-hmm.
and in like the first year I'd gone through every book she had.
And tell me what sort of music theory was it?
It was like identifying intervals, key signatures, You know, basically the basic system the stuff basic of our system, Western system.
Musicianship stuff. Chords. So that's not really music theory at that point, just like...
We call it theory.
We call it theory.
Even at the higher ends, it's still not really theory. That's not it's theory. Practice.
That's practice. Yeah, but that's but I understand what you mean. That's like the I mean, it's derived from
the structure. It's our group cultural coherence creating scenario.
Anyway, it's funny because it does. It's just
once you realize that what's going on in music from other cultures and stuff, you realize, oh, okay, this is actually just our bag. It's not the whole universe of what you can do with this stuff. Funny thing, I think it's an American thing, you know. Well, the thing is, it's an adult thing, and when you're a little kid, you just like, okay, it's B-E-A-D-G-C-F. Yeah, it's cool. They go like this. You know, they kind of make a little zigzag pattern, and if you follow the zigzag pattern, you know, and then you learn like cool things like, oh, it's always like one key behind, mm-hmm. you know? So if you C, then there's no flats. If you have F, then there's a B flat. But then if you have the B flat, you have the B flat and the E flat. So you're always one, you know, or the last sharp is but you just go half step up, below, or, you know, like you learn these things and you don't think to ask, well, why does it go this way?
Yeah.
You know, it's only with the adult beginners. But now all we have are adult beginners because the music education is so... I don't know why it is, and I will say this, and I probably will get crap about it, but I don't know why it is that the only people in the world who don't think that you need to know music theory are the people who are going to teach children music.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's really peculiar right now, but I mean, I get a sense. I mean, that's why I'm spending time talking to people like you about music, because I just think that a lot
but
of
it's funny because
people don't have.
My piano teacher, Diana Arlick, was really into teaching that stuff. Not for the purposes of becoming a composer, but so you could become a perfect sight reader.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is a lot of younger musicians don't realize this, but you cannot really read music without the theory.
No, you can't.
You're reading it, but you might as well be, a Japanese person trying to read Shakespeare phonetically. You don't understand what you're reading.
Yeah, I mean, it's a curious thing. It's just because the language of that writing developed the same time as the structural ideas that are just physically in the sound. So where it's developing parallel. I mean, it's just like not having it. It would be like if we were using the words, but there was no syntax. You know, we just started to drop the words in any damn place, and after a while, you just have gibberish.
Have you seen that postmodern paper generating website?
No,
Tom's. Oh, it's great.
Yeah,
check it out sometime.
So I take a look at that. So let me see here, because we don't have too long on this first part. I'll come back and talk to you again another time, so we didn't get very far at all. But I want to get back to this Arthur Cunningham thing with the. So he looks at over your Crosby, Stills, and Nash effort, and he's not impressed, and he's going to move toward East.
So he starts in with, and then he's like, okay, you want to learn jazz, so then there was a lot of more fundamentals, but now fundamentals at the piano. Mm-hmm. So it's like, here's the blues scale. Mm-hmm. Learn this, here are the scales. Mm-hmm. You know, like you have to learn to play all these scales. Mm-hmm. You have to learn to play them in tenths. You have to learn to play them in contrary motion. Here's the blues scale. You have to learn to play this in every key. Mm-hmm. Here are your basic chords, like, you know, chord functions, and here's the blues progression, and here you have to learn to play this in every key. Here's these voicing patterns, and you have to follow them through around the circle of fifths, and you have to play them in every key. So there's a huge range of it's like theory at the piano. And all the different kinds of chords and stuff. And around that same time, he was like, well, you know, you really need to do this classical stuff. And so then he busted out the Bach.
And how did you feel that this classical stuff was different than what you were doing with your previous teacher?
It was coming to me with... It was a question of not just playing the piece, but learning to understand it, coming to know it.
So there's coherence.
Yes. So suddenly it was like coherence, and
So, so let me ask a question now. So, in the mind, in the mind of the kid, that was, what's the relationship between this and the Beatles? Said you, you want to, you know, you, I want to do that. I want to do the Beatles, and we're not that far after this strikes you. And how are you feeling? The, I mean, is this still something you're like, oh, if I get this, I'll really be able to play the Beatles?
Yeah, that one. Yeah. Okay. Well, I had this confused notion that somehow by being a great musician, one would become successful.
Uh-huh. Right.
Which I found to not be true.
Yeah, yeah. Can but we say that louder? That time, it turns out that's not true.
But at that time, it seemed like that was the way to go, you know? That was the road to go. Okay, and so in the midst of this, I'm studying with Arthur. I'm playing with the guy, doing the jam out crazy stuff. Uh-huh. Arthur is also hammering away at me the idea that jazz, I mean, he's telling me very, in no uncertain terms, things like, if you sound like somebody else, you're a thief.
Yeah, right.
And jazz is about expansion of consciousness and cultural awareness, and you need to go to all these concerts. And so he told my parents that I had to go to a concert every month. Mm-hmm. And so, he told them I should go to a lot of concerts, and they decided to give me money to go to a concert once a month.
Great.
And so the first one I picked was Mingus at, and I didn't know that much, I didn't know anything about Mingus, you know, but then so I picked this concert basically because I looked in the New York Times and it looked like it was a big deal, and it was this thing, this guy, Charles Mingus, who I'd kind of heard about, you know, that he was cool, maybe he smoked pot even, and it was at Lincoln Center and the New York Philharmonic, and Bill Cosby was going to be the MC, and it's a classic concert now, you can buy the recording. And I went to that and just had my brain blown out of the back of my skull.
Yeah.
This was shortly afterwards, followed up with a bunch of my dope-smoking moron friends and I piling into a car to go down to Passaic, New Jersey to see Johnny Winter, buying eighth-row orchestra seats at the show, being thrilled, going into the place, purchasing LSD in the bathroom, sitting down in the eighth row before we looked at the tickets and realized, this isn't Johnny Winter. Who's this mother? This is John McLaughlin? What's this? And the guy comes out and he asks for, like, silence at the beginning of the show. And then after, like, 5 minutes, Billy Cobham hits the gong and the acid kicks in. And my friends all leave. They're like, we'll see you later. They can't take it. They leave. They go out and, like, hang out in Passaic, New Jersey in the street waiting for me to get done. And I sit there. And once again, whatever was left of my brains was then cleared out.
Right.
And then, like, 2 weeks after that, my friend Jack Lovinger, the jazz drummer, took me down and snuck me in. I don't know. The drinking age in New York was 18. Mm. I can't imagine that I looked 18. I'm sure they just looked the other way. Because he took me down to the Village Vanguard to hear somebody I'd really never heard of. Mm-hmm. It was this guy, Tony Williams, and this band, Lifetime. Mm-hmm. And then that was it. I was gone. And I went home after the Tony Williams show. I went home and I was wired and I stayed up for like 12 hours and I wrote my first kind of speed metal progressive jazz fusion muscle tune. And then when I went to the rock band, I insisted that they all learn the tong, which took like 6 months. And we changed the whole thing over into, a Mahavishnu, more progressive Hendrix kind of a thing. And that was, which was very odd, because there we were, 16 years old, and playing this incredibly difficult and complex music. And we blew everybody away, but on the other hand, nobody could believe it.